Nurse Association of the Minutes. Mr. Domina, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of the Daughters of Frances Tolliver, who was dying of cancer when she sought hospice care to assist her with the dying process. Her daughter and she shopped for hospice care, identified an organization that claimed to be a hospice care provider, entered into a commercial contract for hospice care services, and did not receive what they contracted for. They later found out that the facility with which they contracted wasn't a hospice facility at all. Although, when they went to it, they saw this on its front door. And when Frances, who was...
You're saying that that has a generic meaning to everyone, hospice means?
It has, Your Honor. We contend that that term has a dual meaning, both a generic meaning, and it has a legal meaning, because a hospice care facility, by definition under regulations of the State Department of Health, not only connotes, but requires a level of care for which these people were contracted. They thought they were getting it because of what they were told before they contracted. They thought that they were getting it because of what this lady was requested to sign as she checked in. Over and over again, she was told she was going to a hospice facility. She was getting hospice care from people who were schooled and educated at helping people die dignified and pain-free deaths. Instead, what happened was that on January 9, when she moved in, the care that she began to experience was readily identified by her loved ones as substandard, but she was day after day and even hour after hour sicker and sicker. So her family was trapped at moving her out. One family member, a niece, who happens to be a master's degree nurse, an advanced nurse practitioner, testified that the daily care before we get to the malpractice with the medicine was substandard and inappropriate and did not conform with a hospice care standard. That's Nurse Campbell.
That all goes to your attention on negligent misrepresentation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's for the pain and suffering, is that correct?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And it's for a longer period of time than the malpractice.
And June 27th.
That's correct.
The record indicates a stipulation. I'll draw your attention to it. And this came after the Court of Appeals went back on show cause. You recall that?
I remember that happening.
Yeah,
I'm
confused by it. It says the parties have worked out an agreement and a stipulation for the claim of the defendant's conscious pain and suffering included in the court's judgment on March 14, 2008. That would be the entry of a jury verdict. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Have worked out an agreement that the claim of the deceased's conscious pain and suffering was included in the court's judgment of March 14, 2008. That was a jury verdict.
Yes.
And then the court says, well, the court will accept the party stipulation and enter an order pursuant to the party stipulation. The court will enter an order clarified in the judgment entered on March 14, 2008 that it did include the deceased's conscious pain and suffering claim. What does that mean?
Your Honor, I think that what we were trying to do was to make it clear under 1315 that there wasn't some lingering claim in the district court. There were conscious pain and suffering claims here that started on June 9, and this care commenced at this facility. The decedent died on July 1. The active period of under medication by withdrawal of a duragesic patch, one of multiple medications, because of an inappropriate action by a nurse named Tiki Mom, occurred on June 20, and that was cured on June 28.
So, but as to the prior conscious pain and suffering, which was not included in that, that wouldn't result directly from the licensure issue that you know. It would have to result either from some substandard care that the patient received once she was in this facility?
Two responses to that. And I think that is the nub of the question about whether there is a harmless error here, Your Honor. And I think that there are two responses that make that issue be resolved in our favor. The first is that we were contracting for a level of care. And that level of care was here. What we got was this level of care at assisted living. And it's because of that gap in knowledge and experience and attention and licensure and ability to provide care that conscious pain and suffering occurred. That's the best reason. The second best reason, of course, is a more of a genuflect, but it's often cited in your decisions, and that is the proximate cause questions belong to the trier of fact. So I think that the conscious pain and suffering claim, and I appreciate being reminded of the stipulation, which I have not focused on, is not all swept up into the malpractice claim because of the period of time.
In terms of parents, it looks like. It looks like you're saying that all this is included in that jury verdict. Pre-June 27th and after.
And I think what we're really saying is that it's all included in the judgment, so that there was one judgment, there weren't claims about different times and different decisions, and we were properly here before you on the end.
So that'd be claimed from June 20 to June 27th, is that?
There are, and to be sure that I'm answering correctly, the malpractice period is June 20 to June 28, actually. That's when the dergesic patch is replaced.
Right.
The period of residency is June 9 to July 1.
Well, when was the patch taken off? That was June 27.
June 20. Yeah. The call identifying that it was gone was the 27th. The replacement of the patch actually occurred after midnight, so it's on the 28th. Early morning hours of the 28th.
So what do you contend was the cause of the prior pain and suffering that was not included, apparently not included in this work?
We contend, Your Honor, that the persons who were employed at the hospice house and were supervisors of those persons lacked the requisite knowledge and skill and ability to provide adequate care to prevent pain.
But isn't that just a standard tort? Concept.
It would be if they had been licensed to provide it, and if we were asking ourselves the question, was the standard of care to which a professional person licensed at level X is held? Our problem here is that we would then be applying an RN standard of care against CNAs. We expected registered nurse care. We got CNA care. And we were at that disparate level of attention and care because of the fraud that induced this lady to check in as a patient. This is an egregious case. Old people dying with few choices and a facility associated with respected healthcare organizations apparently taking some corporate lawyer's shortcut at licensure and holding down care costs. That's what's going on here. They're operating as an assisted living facility because it's cheaper, inducing people to think they're getting a higher quality level and higher standard of care.
But your point is that to recognize pain and suffering, under your misrepresentation claims, we would have to adopt 557A?
Yes, because here the trial court concluded correctly that we did not prove disparate cost.
Has any other court extended it?
In cases like this one?
Pain and suffering.
The cases we cited and the cases that the other side cited here are all cases involving misrepresentation about sexual health, or in one case, parents to a child about medical history of a proposed fiance they didn't like. We don't have a case quite like this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Welch, good morning.
Hey, please, court. My name is Dave Welch. I represent the Appalachian.
Well, before you get started, could you shed some light on the stipulation? What was meant there?
Yes, Your Honor. in the early going of the appeal, the Court of Appeals sent back the standard jurisdictional letter, and this particular case, they wanted to clear up, make sure all final matters that they concluded within the litigation, and they had. The stipulation that was entered into, and I entered into with Mr. Dama's associate, not Mr. Dama, but down there in the court in front of Judge Doherty, when I worked this out, was to include that all the pain and suffering was addressed within the judgment entered by the jury. Okay, and that's our position in this case. I don't know if there was some mistake on their part or not.
Well, if your interpretation is correct, then it would all be subsumed in that judgment.
Well, that's my argument to begin with, whether that stipulation should stand or not. I just wanted the case to get going to the appeal, but my position is the jury had the case. They took it on the negligence. It was submitted to them, and they made a determination based upon pain and suffering, and they determined that they did find, against my argument, that there was pain and suffering, and they awarded $12,500 in regard to pain and suffering. One thing I want to point out before I don't get a chance to is that the actual Duragene patch issue, when it was not changed, was June 27th, not June 20th. I just want to make sure that's clear. What happened on this particular case, this woman comes in to the hospice house on June 9th. With her would have been her daughter, Patricia Tolliver, her power of attorney, who would have executed the document with her. It's clear up front what the hospice house is. It's an assisted living facility where we team with hospice agencies. We team either with the VNA, Methodist Hospital, or Allegiance. And you'll see in the exhibit up front when she had to pick a hospice provider. That's how the VNA gets involved in this case. She picked the VNA to be her hospice provider. And the way it works is the assistants, the CNAs, the LPN, they're at the hospice house. And then you have your hospice team, Mr. Griffin's case, the VNA, and they daily monitor the care of this patient. And obviously the key to the care is the doctor that awards or enters the prescription for whatever medication is being provided. In this particular case, she started off with a Duragene patch at 25 micrograms. That was from June 9th to June 21st. And that same time, she was receiving Percocet. The Duragene patch is consistent, is long-lasting medication. It's on there 72 hours before you change it. The short-acting medication, the breakthrough medication you give would be when somebody's in a lot of pain, would be like the Percocet. That was changed on the 21st as her pain, she's dying. She's in the dying process. Your pain is going to start increasing. She has terminal cancer. She had Merkel cell carcinoma. And on the 21st, they upped the Duragene patch to 50, pursuant to the doctor's order, and then they went from Percocet to at that point, oxycodone. And then that was that way until the 24th, when the pain was getting worse. And then at that point in time, they went to 100 micrograms on the Duragene patch, and they went to Roxanol, which is morphine. And on the 24th, she could no longer swallow. So what you do is you put the Roxanol under the tongue, and that's how it's absorbed. So that was the short-acting medication. When you read the transcript, the first time anybody starts complaining that their mother's not getting the proper care that they think, it's about the 22nd or 23rd. That's the first time.
What was that complaint?
The complaint was the daughter was saying, well, mom's in more pain than she should be in. Their testimony, that's when they're identifying.
They're alleging that nursing staff is not monitoring the patient closely enough to determine?
Their allegations were that they're...
Because as a practical matter, the doctor never showed.
Right. And they don't, under a practical matter. They set the medication and the doctor's not there. They're saying
so
their mom's in more pain.
The entire care of the patient is going to be dependent upon the observation of the nursing staff.
Right, and the RN that comes in, the director of the VNA, the RN, who is following the care, and then the RN, the VNA also has pastoral care coming in, social workers and other people working with the family. It's a whole unit type situation.
I understand, but what they're concerned with is the observation of the physical symptoms of the patient in order to provide adequate pain medication during that time.
Right, and their complaint started about the 23rd, and the argument was at trial, that they did not give enough of the Rocinol, once it was changed to the Rocinol, that they could have given more. Now, the doctor's order says, like any prescription, you can give up to this. Well, they gave less than that to a certain extent, because they thought they were controlling her pain in that respect. And so the argument was that they weren't giving enough Rocinol and controlling her pain roughly from the 23rd, and then on the 27th, is when the Duragesic patch was not changed. The nurse made a determination that the patient was in the last dying phase. She's maudlin at that point in time. So let's just keep with the Rocinol. The Duragesic patch probably isn't going to work.
You said she's maudlin. What's that?
It's a system within your body where your body's dying from the outside in. And they don't, the Duragesic patch is on your skin. It's probably not going to be a...
Excuse me, well, there's two periods of pain and suffering that they're claiming. That's... June 27th, you say, when they took the patch off.
Right.
And the pain and suffering before that.
And the jury had them both, and the testimony from our experts were that we were negligent in regards to both of those, and that both went to the jury. So the jury decided that in the negligent part of the case.
And how was the instructions framed as far as pain and suffering?
Just talk about pain and suffering in general. And that's what the jury had. And the argument was made that she was in pain and suffering on the 23rd, 24th, 25th, and then we didn't change the Duragesic patch, and then she was in more pain. The jury got all of that, and the jury decided all of that in regards to that respect. In regards to a misrepresentation case, as we're here about, first off, the facts I would support, there was no misrepresentation. Secondly, in that respect, the law is clear in Nebraska that it's got to be a pecuniary damage for a misrepresentation case. They're trying to now create new law by saying pain and suffering should be part. Well, this is an economic tort. For them to start including this type of damage in economic torts would create a lot of problems. You'd have, every time you have a malpractice case, now you'd have a misrepresentation case, and every time you have a breach of contract case, you're going to have an element of damage for compensatory damages, pain and suffering. There are no cases that I see in my analysis of the jurisdictions around the country that have really adopted 557. Those two cases that are cited, one from Maryland, one from Minnesota, the Alphabet Herbie case, that basically say, well, there is a cause of action for misrepresentation. But the one important thing I think you should look at is that Doe versus Dealing, which was the Illinois case that we relied upon, the Court of Appeals there did try to expand the tort of misrepresentation pursuant to 557A, restatement second. And the Supreme Court reversed that and said, no, you cannot expand in regards to this particular tort. And I think the law is clear, and the Court of Appeals went through it very, very well in addressing in the Burke versus Harmon case, citing exactly what restatement second of torts 449 for fraud, the restatement section of torts 559 for negligence, that it's a pecuniary damage. Now, granted, the only case that the Supreme Court addressed misrepresentation was way back in the 1950s. It's a marriage case, and the guy sues, claiming that he was giving some woman some money, and that's the Harsh versus Sis case that's cited within the brief. And the court there determines that pain and suffering are a compensatory type damage. It is not available in these type of cases. There was another assignment of error that was given in this particular case, and that is that Dr. Dubay, one of their experts, was not allowed to give an opinion in regard to the damages. I had objected to all three of their experts that gave testimony in regards to whether the resident sustained more pain than she should have sustained had she been given the proper medications. Judge Dockey let the first two experts testify to that. One was a niece RN who did hospice care, Nurse Gamble, testified to it that the patient was in more pain than she should have been in pursuant to the breach of the standard of care that they identified. And the second was Nurse Eilers, who was a PhD nurse who had set up oncology and hospice programs in the state and probably the leading authority in regards to hospice care in the state of Nebraska. That person also was allowed to give an opinion over objection. They tried to give an opinion from a pharmacist whether this patient was in more pain than she should have been in pursuant to the medications that were being given, and Judge Donahue did exclude that. Her opinion was correct, her decision was correct in that the pharmacist did not have the foundation. I see that I'm running out of time, if anybody has any questions, I'm certainly happy to answer those questions. Thank you, I request that you affirm the directed verdict of the trial court in regards to this representation, that you affirm the district court's ruling in excluding the opinion of their expert, Mr. Dubay.
Thank you very much. How much time do we have? 1 minute, Mr. Dubay.
May it please the court, you know, Francis Tyler is not the only person who was deceived about what this facility was. Her prescribing doctor, a PhD just described as the leading authority in the state on hospice care, an advanced nurse practitioner, and a pharmacist to describe as one of the two leading pharmacists specialized on pain in the United States, who happens to be from Nebraska. Two of whom were university medical professor faculty members in the community where this facility is located, all thought it was a licensed hospice facility until they found out it wasn't in this case. Francis Tolliver did not lose $32 a day. The difference between hospice care and this care, or whatever that difference is, as the fair and responsible measure of her damages. She died differently than she wanted to die. She didn't die at peace. She got half her medicine, not only from the 20th, the entire time. And we didn't give her case away in stipulation. Thank you.
Thank you.